Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How powerful is the President of the United States? And have Congress and the Supreme Court given up some of their own rights to check and balance the actions of the Commander-in-Chief? My guest today has observed extraordinary expansion in the powers claimed by presidents over the past three decades, and he says both Republican and Democratic presidents have played a role. Peter M. Shane is Jacob E. Davis and Jacob E. Davis II Chair in Law at Ohio State University's Moritz College of Law. His new book is called Madison's Nightmare, How Executive Power Threatens American Democracy. Peter, welcome to Think.
Well, thank you very much.
I guess I want to start by talking, before we go into Madison's nightmare, about his dream. What sort of system did he believe was necessary to promote and protect democracy?
Well, I suppose to honor Madison, we should note that the word he probably would have used would not have been democracy, but republicanism. But his view of republicanism very much matches the kinds of values that we treasure today about our constitutional system. He believed in a deliberate pursuit of the public interest, in the general interest of all. He wrote a lot about overcoming faction and the spirit of faction. And his dream was, what I've called his dream, was the notion that you could design the institutions of government in such a way that even though human beings are imperfect and people in power tend to have their ambitions tend to overflow perhaps the appropriate channels of their authority, that you could design the institutions of government so that they could, to use the familiar phrase, check and balance one another and keep one another focused on the pursuit of the public interest.
So no matter what individual got out of control, there would be others to sort of put that person in line.
Right. And, mm-hmm. and the way what's fascinating about the design, and it's almost it really is truly one of the most brilliant acts, I guess, of political statesmanship in human history, was the thought that the way to do this was to make the big institutions of government, and we're talking now mainly about the three branches of the federal government, not only authorized to stop each other in various ways. I mean, the president could veto legislation, Congress could cut off appropriations, the courts could hold things unconstitutional, but they were also made dependent on one another in a variety of ways, so that it's not just that each branch knows if I overstep my bounds, there's somebody here who could cut me off. But they also need to think about, and in, to some extent, particularly with regard to the president and Congress, they need to kind of involve each other in their ambitions, because they know that in order to accomplish what needs to be accomplished, at some point, the other branch is going to have to sign off. And so that mutual dependence is a very important check.
So how does the presidency in the 21st century differ from the framers' intentions?
Well, there are many, many ways.
At least as regarding your book.
Where to begin? Well, of course, the presidency, the national government that they designed was designed in a context in which the federal government was just a much less powerful day-to-day actor in people's lives than has now, become commonplace, largely because, of course, they were involved in a world that did not have electronic communications, it did not have high-speed transportation, in which you didn't have essentially this national common market that extended from, the coast of Maine to the coast of Southern California and so forth. So the presidency that they were looking at was the presidency of a much smaller operation. And the way they conceived of the president, I don't want to perhaps oversimplify this too much, they weren't necessarily thinking of the president in purely mechanical terms, but what they were looking for in the presidency was wisdom and effective management. Their notion of the president and the election of a president as a kind of national plebiscite on public policy, that's not their frame of mind. That is a much more post-Jacksonian, modern, democratic way of viewing what presidents are all about. They weren't thinking of the presidency as much of a, as a representative institution as a managerial institution. Now, it has grown enormously as the country has grown, and the trend towards a larger and more powerful presidency didn't just start with the Reagan administration. Clearly, the Depression, World War II, the New Deal, these things vastly expanded Americans' ideas of what was appropriate with regard to executive power. And in a sense, there's been a kind of steady uphill climb since the 30s and 40s. But what my book looks at most intensely is the period between 1981 and 2009, the Reagan through the Bush 43 administrations, which I treat as being somewhat distinctive. And the reason I think they're distinctive is not just the claims that were being made for presidential power or the grants of power that were being made explicitly by Congress. What was distinctive is the degree to which the executive branch was claiming that the president had a vast swath of power, both domestic and foreign, that really were beyond either judicial review or congressional oversight. So the president was, and this really hit its zenith, I guess, under the George W. Bush administration. But beginning with the Reagan administration, you just began to see much more adventurous arguments for what I call a doctrine of aggressive presidentialism, the idea that the president just has these broad, expansive, inherent powers that really nobody else could check except perhaps the electorate, the one time you actually get to decide whether the person deserves a second term.
So this started under Reagan and, as you said, sort of reached its zenith under President George W. Bush. But we have to say here there was a Democratic president there for 8 years, Bill Clinton, and this did not change radically in his administration.
No. And there are a variety of reasons for that. And I guess one thing, the way I put it in the book is, you know, presidents want power. And presidents want power whether they are ideologically committed to the notion of broad executive power or because they are, and I don't mean this word in a bad way, opportunistic. They want to take the opportunities that they have to fulfill the agenda for which they thought that they were elected. In terms of, there is nothing like, for example, under the Clinton administration, the extraordinary use of the presidential signing statement to lodge hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of objections to the constitutionality of laws that the president was signing into effect. There were no claims of inherent wiretapping authority beyond the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. There were a bunch of things, you know, that the Bush administration, you know, came up with that the Clinton administration would not have come up with. But on the other hand, it has to be said that when, for example, the president believed it was in American interest to commit U.S. air power to defeat Slobodan Milosevic and get Serbia out of Kosovo, he proceeded on a legal argument that was really thin, you know, certainly as thin as any claim for inherent presidential war power that had been made in the previous decades. And perhaps even more interesting on the domestic front, and you know, this can be a little subtle, but although presidents have always enjoyed and are conceded to have a lot of influence over domestic administrative agencies, it generally had been the view before the Clinton administration that presidents couldn't actually tell, for example, the Secretary of Labor how to regulate labor. That was her job. If she didn't do the job the way the president wanted, the president could, you know, fire her and replace her. But as much influence as the president could have by persuading and appointing and budgeting, when push came to shove, the president would not be issuing orders saying, XYZ agency, I hereby command that you do the following. And the Clinton administration did move in that direction, largely in response to the Republican takeover of Congress. To use the word that was always being used at the time, President Clinton wanted to show that the president was still relevant, and the way he did that was by a more vigorous use of the administrative bureaucracy. His the legal theory he had for it was actually not so aggressive. I mean, he had a way of reading the federal statutes that Congress has enacted as giving him that power. Again, the Bush administration kind of trumped him by saying, no, it's the Constitution that gives us that power. We can tell agencies what to do no matter what Congress says. But yes, there was this steady stream of, you know, upward or more aggressive presidential authority that extended across the Clinton years as well.
And just to clarify here, essentially the Constitution does not, it allows the president to choose the leaders of these federal agencies, but not to have any direct impact on what they're doing.
Well, the president, the agencies of government, are, of course, beyond the president and vice president and Congress and the court and the Supreme Court, all of those things are created by Congress. And when Congress creates an agency, Congress must allow the president to nominate the head of the agency, and the president then appoints that person if the Senate confirms the nominee. The president submits budgets for all the agencies. The president has a lot of can make recommendations for how Congress enacts legislation, so he makes recommendations as to which agencies get what kinds of power and so forth. And, of course, you know, the president is choosing people who are politically pretty much on the same wavelength. So at the level of general values, you wouldn't expect you wouldn't expect President Obama to choose, you know, as a Secretary of State, somebody who didn't believe in international dialogue. You wouldn't have expected George W. Bush to choose a Secretary of Labor who was very much pro-union. So at the level of general values, there's going to be consistency. But again, until I think, until the Reagan administration and this idea of the unitary presidency, presidents did not think that they would have the power to actually call up the head of EPA, for example, and say, I know you could regulate sulfur dioxide in three ways. I'm telling you, go with option two. That's the innovation.
And let's go back once again to this issue of signing statements, which were used to an unprecedented degree during the Bush, the second Bush administration. These are essentially little notes that are added to legislation that a president has not chosen to veto, but that basically say, I am not going to do what this legislation requires me to do.
Well, I guess first, just to be lawyerly about this, of course, the signing statement doesn't get added to the legislation. It's not part of the law. Presidents have always, when they sign bills into law, have often uttered something. I mean, typically what they've said is, what a great day this is for the United States, that Congress has enacted this wonderful statute that I am now signing that will make the country better off. Over the years, really going back to the Monroe administration, there were occasions on which a president would say, I'm signing this into law, I think it's a great thing, except for one piece of it about which I have some constitutional doubt. Now, what presidents have said then may vary. Sometimes if the statute requires the president to do something and he doesn't think Congress can mandate that he do it, typically the president will say, I will take that under advisement, you know, but I won't regard it as mandatory. Occasionally he will say he will ignore a provision. But these things, as you say, they multiplied exponentially under the Bush administration. I've only completed a count of the first 6 years in which he made over 1,400 objections to provisions of law that he was signing into law.
Peter M. Shane is my guest. He is chair in law at Ohio State University's Moritz College of Law. His new book is called Madison's Nightmare, How Executive Power Threatens American Democracy. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Peter M. Shane. His new book is called Madison's Nightmare, How Executive Power Threatens American Democracy. You can join us by sending an email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. So, Peter, what makes aggressive presidentialism so detrimental to the way we run this country?
Well, there are really two levels, I guess, which I would want to address that. One, just to say very briefly, the doctrine of aggressive presidentialism was given a legal defense by the most recent Bush administration, but also going back to his father's administration, the Reagan administration, that is just an implausible reading of the Constitution. So if you think it's bad for our governance to have people in charge who are simply misreading the Constitution, that's a problem. But the bigger problem, and maybe the more practical problem, is that if you have an organization, and of course, you know, the executive branch is a very large organization or set of organizations, operating on the assumption that a great deal of what they are doing, they are entitled to do pretty much according to their own lights and without either a court being able to check whether you're operating within legal boundaries or Congress really being able to investigate and hold accountable those people who are administering the law, it's very likely in that situation that you're going to develop a very inward-looking, defensive, aggressive, but not highly consultative way of making decisions. And you can see that really in the work of the Justice Department since 9/11. There's been a lot of controversy over the so-called torture memos and other memoranda of the Office of Legal Counsel that supported anti-terrorist initiatives by the executive branch that really had very dubious, if any, legal basis to them. And if you look at those memos, what's shocking about them is not just the results that they've reached, but how little account they seem to take of any position other than the one that the client starts with. And that I think, is in a pluralistic society like ours, where the public is so fluid in its thinking, it's made up of people with such diverse interests, needs, backgrounds, experiences, to reduce government dialogue so stringently because basically you think you have the constitutionally vested authority to do whatever you want, that really is laying, I think, a groundwork for some very bad decision-making.
Of course, some defenders of aggressive presidentialism will say it's not about trying to use the Constitution to do whatever they want, but that it is necessary, given the current state of the world, to have a president stronger than the one envisioned by the framers, if for no other reason than it's efficient to have one person sort of making these kinds of decisions. What do those arguments fail to recognize?
Well, first of all, the president today clearly is and would be under any reading of the Constitution a far stronger institution than the framers imagined, simply because the United States is so much bigger and more powerful a country. So that's not, I think, really the issue. The question is, do you need, in order to have a strong presidency, is it necessary to have, or is it even helpful to have, this notion of inherent presidential power that is largely accountable to no one? That's where I think the dispute is. And the champions of the unitary presidency, the idea that the president has these authorities, typically say, well, the president is the one official who everybody gets to vote for. He is the embodiment of the national interest and is really in a superior position to make sure that public policy really reflects the will of the American people. And that's just a huge oversimplification, both of our electoral system, which is itself in bad need of repair, but also it's just implausible that any single elected official at any moment is going to represent the public interest and the public will on every single issue. The best way for achieving the most appropriate direction for public policy, I think, really is through a kind of dialogue and deliberation among the branches of government. And I guess I want to be clear about, you know, one point that I'm making, and that is there are people who would argue not just the position I'm trying to argue, which is that the president should not be regarded as having these broad inherent authorities. There are people who would argue, of course, that Congress should not give the president legal authority to do things also. I mean, what the president is now doing, for example, with regard to fiscal stimulus is not based on any claim by the Obama administration that the Constitution authorizes the president to rescue the economy. It's based on statutes that Congress has enacted that allow him to do what he's doing. And there are many people who would say, well, that was bad. Congress shouldn't have given the executive branch those authorities. My view is, number one, I'm not as worried about that, because if the president recognizes that the power he has comes from Congress and then he is accountable to Congress, by and large, it won't be perfect, but you would expect the president to act in a more accountable, more publicly responsible way. And the second thing I would say is, yes, we're living in a dangerous world. We're living in a world where presidents are required to act vigorously in a lot of settings. But as the stimulus experience shows, when the emergency is genuine, the president's capacity to mobilize Congress and get fairly quick action in regard to a clear national need, he's in a pretty good position. So I think what's not so clear is that we've seen even in our recent history examples where these claims of the president's need to act quickly and efficiently and unilaterally have contributed anything to the resolution of an actual national problem.
So, Peter, setting aside all the arguments for and against aggressive presidentialism, the question that I can't get out of my mind is why we haven't seen more pushback on this from the other two branches of the federal government.
Ah, that is a great question. The answer with regard to the courts is pretty straightforward. The courts are not in a position to mobilize an independent agenda. The courts can only react to cases that have been brought to them. And in doing so, the court has to not only worry about the way the Constitution is written with regard to the presidency, they also have to respect the limits that the Constitution places on the court's own decision-making power. So in order to challenge something that the president has done or the executive branch has done, it's not enough, for example, that you or I might disagree with it and want a court to put them on the right path. There actually has to be a case where somebody can show that they were directly injured by this action, has standing in a federal court to challenge it and move forward. And that just doesn't happen that often. And indeed, before the Nixon administration, it was generally assumed that it would be very hard to sue the executive branch in a lot of cases, so that almost all of the law that the courts have made with regard to the presidency has been made since 1974. I mean, there are important cases before that, but United States versus Nixon was really a big turning point in the judiciary's role with regard to the presidency.
That being said, though, you do say that there are, although the Supreme Court can't really recalibrate the way we do checks and balances in this country, there are three primary things that you would love to see the courts consider if the cases come before them.
Right. Well, the one thing, and the things that something that Congress has already, I think, started in some sense to turn its attention to is the scope of the state secrets privilege. The scope of privileges in litigation, that is, the authority of anybody not to turn over information that's been demanded, depends really on the judicial definition of the scope of that privilege. I think that the courts have probably gone further than the Constitution requires them to go in order to recognize the capacity or the entitlement of the executive branch to withhold documents. And there's actually been a lot of controversy over this with regard even to the Obama administration, because I think critics of the Bush administration were imagining that the Obama administration would work much more quickly to overturn the way the federal government asserted state secrets privilege. What the president has said is that he has that under review, but there has not yet been a change in the legal understanding, at least the executive branch's willingness to assert a fairly vigorous state secrets privilege claim. So that, I think, is a big one. A second thing that I'd mention, and again, you have to be a little bit of an administrative law geek, I suppose, to care about this, but there are a variety of cases in which the executive branch will interpret what is conceitedly an ambiguous statute, and the courts have been very deferential to how the executive branch resolves statutory ambiguity. In cases when, let's say Congress...
This is the Chevron doctrine?
This is the Chevron doctrine. Ah, so you are an administrative law geek.
No, I just read your book.
Well, thank you. Right, so under the Chevron doctrine, if Congress writes an ambiguous environmental statute, and the Environmental Protection Agency, given its expertise and its legal authority over the environment, resolves the ambiguity in a certain way, well, then perhaps it is appropriate for a federal court to be deferential. But what I have suggested is that if the White House intervenes, if it's the White House saying to the EPA, we hereby tell you as the White House how to resolve this ambiguity, that the White House is not expert in environmental policy. They don't have any inherent constitutional authority over the environment, the court shouldn't be deferential. That doesn't mean that the White House is automatically wrong. It's just that the court should give that a hard look. And then the third thing, and the third thing that I want the courts to do really goes to the other question you asked, which is why hasn't Congress done more? And that is, I would like to see the courts more willing to police the gerrymandering of electoral districts. Right now, we have a system of election districting in which every state legislature is required to create congressional districts that are very close to equal in population. But that's pretty much it. If a legislature wants to do so, it is pretty much free to set up those districts to protect all of the incumbent members of Congress so that a state legislature, for example, it's dominated by the Democrats or Republicans, it makes no difference, but the members of one party can just draw the congressional districts in their state to make sure that every district they currently control is safely in their hands, and to make it as hard as possible for the opposing party to compete in the remaining districts. And as a result of that, number one, everyone who is elected to Congress stands an overwhelming chance of perpetual reelection unless they really screw up. I mean, certainly, in the joke that in the 80s and 90s and the early 2000s, members of Congress enjoyed rates of reelection that would have made the Soviet Politburo positively envious because of the absence of electoral competition. It also means that the members of Congress know, members of Congress in that position are much more likely to just, vote the party line, cater to their base. They may worry a lot about sort of individual constituent service. If you call up because you want help getting your Social Security claim promised, or you want, to have a flag that's flown over the Capitol, to honor your grandparents. I mean, those things, they are very responsive to. But they're not. But members of Congress are not necessarily concerned about politically responsible oversight and accountability, because they may know that their own reelection chances really don't depend on it. It's really partly the weakening of the political parties as centers for debate and creating a kind of institutional basis for the two different big tents. We now have a very strange party system, which we have one very eclectic party and one ideologically much more narrow party that's really been hugely marginalized in the last election. And even within that system, the people who now hold their seats in Congress or the Senate realize that pretty much what they do with regard to the executive branch has very little to do with whether they're going to serve another term.
Of course, presidents do not enjoy this sort of potentially permanent incumbency that we see so often in the legislature, and yet we still have this problem where presidents continue to take more power and use more power. And you make the point that that means, that demonstrates that it's not enough to assume that electing a new president from either party will fix the trend that we're seeing right now.
Yes, and you know, my wife and daughter will tell you that I'm the optimist in the family, and so it's hard for me to. I can't bring myself to say it is hopeless, but I do think that that's right, that, you know, the choice of presidents is very important. And I do think, despite there are ways in which the Obama administration in its early months has seemed ambivalent on issues of presidential power, sometimes being very aggressive, sometimes being more modest, clearly the election makes a difference, and the executive branch will behave differently under President Obama than it would under a President McCain. But it can't be just the president. There really has to be an institutional and political context that constrains presidential ambition. That was the Madisonian idea, the idea that you could design institutions to get people to behave responsibly, even if in their private dreams they might not wish to. And I think that we're going to find ourselves in that position only if there are some kinds of structural and legal change made to the government itself, including making congressional districts more competitive and making the Electoral College, ideally getting rid of the Electoral College, but minimizing the way in which the Electoral College misrepresents the weight of public sentiment.
Peter M. Shane is my guest. He is chair in law at Moritz College of Law at Ohio State University. His new book is called Madison's Nightmare: How Executive Power Threatens American Democracy. We'll take more of your calls and emails in just a moment. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or think at kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, offering a progressive graduate degree with flexible part-time study. You can pursue your passion at SMU, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Peter M. Shane is my guest. His new book is called Madison's Nightmare: How Executive Power Threatens American Democracy. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org. Peter, have the actions required from Congress to recalibrate this balance of power not come, at least in part, because Americans tend to trust their own representative in Congress but dislike the legislature as an institution?
Well, I think it's really a complex set of factors. And in part, of course, a lot of the issues regarding presidential power arise in foreign and military affairs context. An individual member of Congress is aware that if he or she seems to be going after the president in a way that, you know, might limit the president's authority, and something bad happens, then it's the member of Congress who might be, you know, politically vulnerable, and might also just generally be open to the attack that they are, you know, soft on national security, soft on terrorism, you know, unconcerned with the exigent circumstances that the president faces. So I think partly, you know, members of Congress, in my view, have acted not so responsibly as an institution, but I think it's not altogether surprising considering their political incentives. And I think probably that's a perfect example would be the decision to authorize military action against Iraq. you know, many members of Congress had doubts, undoubtedly, about what they were doing. Some claimed that, you know, they were fooled by the administration. To be honest, I'm a little dubious about the sincerity of that. But I think that members of Congress, when they allowed the president to do what he did, were more worried about their electoral good fortune or ill fortune if they didn't give the president what he wanted than they saw any particular advantage to themselves of demanding more oversight or a longer debate.
An email from Scott in Arlington asks, have the lobbying organizations that seem to have more influence than the general public been a part of the change in presidential power?
Well, the lobbying organizations, the big change, of course, and this is not just since 1981, since the New Deal and then again another wave of kind of administrative enthusiasm in the 1960s really created what we think of as the modern administrative state, in which Congress has created, you know, well over 100 federal agencies that have rulemaking authority and really promulgate rules that touch almost every aspect of our economic and social existence, rules that look just like statutes that Congress, you know, you might have thought Congress would have written, but they are not being legislated by Congress. They're coming out of these administrative agencies operating within these very broad statutory grants. When that happened, what that meant for the lobbying industry is, of course, they began to shift their focus of attention away from Congress. I mean, not entirely, obviously, but they devote much more of their effort to lobbying the administrative agency that's actually going to decide exactly the way in which pollution is going to be regulated, the securities markets are going to be strengthened, workplace safety is going to be protected, and so on and so forth. So I don't know. So in a sense, I don't know whether the lobbying sort of apparatus has itself expanded presidential authority as much as the shift to presidential authority has kind of expanded the scope of lobbying activity, because an industry or a special interest that wants to have its way with regard to public policy now really does have to focus on two branches.
Does Congress, even with an authoritarian president, if you want to call it that, have the power at least to force transparency when it comes to making decisions, especially about things like national security?
Well, let's start. Let me start with what I regard as the easy part of that question, which would be domestic regulatory affairs, where the only power the executive branch has is power that Congress gave it in the first place. If Congress had not given the president authority to regulate the environment or regulate the stock market or protect worker safety, the president wouldn't have any authority over any of those things. So Congress is, the Constitution is explicit that Congress has the power not only, well, it has the power to make all laws necessary and proper for carrying its authorities into effect, but it also has the power to make all laws necessary and proper for carrying into effect the powers of all offices of government. So with regard to all of the stuff where the executive authority really depends upon Congress's giving it a license to operate in the first place, there, I think, its authority to provide transparency is very great. Now, there's one controversy within that, which I'll hold off on it for a second, but I would say that's where Congress's power is the broadest. With regard to national security, Congress and the president clearly are operating under a set of shared powers. And although my view of the president's foreign policy and national security powers is narrower than, say, the Bush administration's understanding, there's no doubt that the president as commander-in-chief has certain authorities with regard to the operation of the military in times of war. There's no doubt that he has treaty negotiation power. He has the power to recognize other governments and determine who we will treat as being the legitimate power in charge of any other country. He appoints ambassadors. So there are lots of very significant things he does. At the same time, Congress appropriates, Congress makes war, Congress regulates, declares war, Congress regulates immigration, Congress regulates foreign trade. So in these areas of shared power, I think Congress is on quite strong ground demanding transparency as to Congress. That is, that they can demand that information be shared with Congress to the degree necessary so that they can perform their constitutionally granted powers. It's less, there may be more doubt as to what Congress can force in terms of the executive branch giving up national security-related information if the executive branch thinks that that degree of transparency would somehow compromise its constitutional functions. The thing that I was going to say about the domestic power is the executive branch has long taken the position that executive privilege in its broadest sense allows the executive branch to withhold from public disclosure any sort of internal deliberative document, no matter what the subject. So even if the U.S. Postal Service were deciding, which picture of Michael Jackson to use on a Michael Jackson stamp, the Justice Department would traditionally take the position that the public is entitled to know their final opinion, but they're not entitled to see the preliminary memos in which somebody said, I really want the 1980s Michael Jackson. Somebody else says, no, let's go with the Jackson 5. I mean, those things are somehow thought to be protectable because their disclosure would compromise the capacity of the executive branch to have full and frank deliberations within the executive about policymaking. To some extent, I think there is something to that, but I think that the breadth of the claim as it has been made and the claim as Congress has indulged it in some contexts probably is too broad. And I think one of the many subjects that would be worthy of congressional investigation is whether there could be a recalibration of this so-called deliberative privilege to narrow substantially the executive branch's authority to withhold entirely the evidence of its internal deliberations.
Well, we have an email here from Gary in Dallas who writes, pertaining, for example, to the current questions about whether former Vice President Cheney will be investigated for allegedly keeping secrets from Congress, is holding high-level leaders accountable via congressional investigation a political question or a legal one?
Well, the answer, I think, is both. It's certainly a political one in the sense that there is no way to legally compel the investigation. None of us can go to our local federal court and enjoin Congress to do its job. So in that sense, whether the investigation proceeds will be political. And, of course, the judgment of what constitutes wrongdoing is not always black and white. And so I think if we were to get into questions about whether the former president or vice president violated the Constitution, there might be a lot of room for debate. I think the law is not so ambiguous, for example, as to the meaning of, say, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. So if there were a hearing as to whether or not there were violations of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, that is a question to which someone ought to be able to answer yes or no in a way that would be less controversial. I mean, it'd be politically controversial, but legally it ought to be easier to ascertain than the question, did the president make an undue claim of executive privilege?
You've called for Congress to hold hearings on the separation of powers and how that concept is being applied today. Do you see any political will for that whatsoever?
Well, the way you phrased the question, I can say absolutely yes, in part because both Senator Feingold and Senator Whitehouse of Rhode Island are very concerned about the issue. And in fact, I think each of them has held hearings in recent months that touch on separation of powers and the rule of law in the executive branch. I think a really important test case here is what kind of historical record is going to be developed with regard to the Bush administration's handling of national security. And I don't say this because I have no personal knowledge of either the president or the vice president's kind of personal thought processes, but I'm confident, having worked for the federal government myself in the late 70s and early 80s, that you know, the overwhelming number of people who worked on these questions were people who were motivated by a very deep, sincere, patriotic concern for protecting the interests of their fellow Americans, both their liberty interests and their security interests. And the people, and there are people out to do real harm to the United States. So in saying that there ought to be an investigation, that there ought to be hearings, that there ought to be a historical record, I don't mean that we should be insensitive to the things that I just mentioned, that we should be too quick to impose criminal or civil liability on government officials who are trying to do their conscientious best. But at the same time, if we have any claim to being a democratic republic, that claim rests on the entitlement of the people of the United States to participate in some meaningful way in a discussion of public policy. And if we don't have any real idea of what was being done in our name by the administration, then that public debate just cannot exist. And I understand that members of Congress worry about being regarded as soft on national security or, you know, being looking backward and not forward. And I understand also that the president, who is being asked to solve a massive array of urgent problems, wants to do everything he can to focus our immediate attention on health care and economic recovery and not torture. But I just think that the injury to American democracy if we do not have a full and frank discussion of the national security record of the last 8 years, that injury will be irreparable.
So many people who were in support of President Obama made the assumption that he would let go of a lot of the powers that were sort of asserted during the last administration. We've seen sort of a one step up and two steps back as far as some of that goes. Do we know enough yet about President Obama to judge whether or not he is likely to dissolve some of the powers that were made available to the president during the second Bush administration?
Well, I think it's too early to have a very clear view of things. I think the way things have developed reflects, what is clearly the Obama management style, and it is a management style that I frankly think is a good thing, even though I might be on the camp that wishes that the moves to shift the stance on executive power were happening more quickly. That is, I mean, he really does believe in a pluralistic, deliberative process within the executive branch. He wants to make sure that everybody whose interests are affected by the way in which the Justice Department announces the scope of executive privilege or the scope of the president's military powers, he wants different agencies and different people within those agencies to be able to weigh in with their views. And it is a complex negotiation that he's overseeing. Yes, people hoped he had moved faster. In some ways, I had hoped he would move faster, but it's too early to tell what the bottom line is going to be.
The new book by Peter M. Shane is called Madison's Nightmare: How Executive Power Threatens American Democracy. Peter, great conversation. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.